Okay. We're at chapter 5, verse 26 in Kings. And we were talking about a partnership between Shlomo and Shlomo HaMelech and the king Hiram, who was the king of Tyre, of Seir. And we mentioned that it's interesting, in verse 26 it says that Hashem gave Shlomo wisdom and there was peace. And what it tells us is that you have to be smart to have peace. Like sometimes if you, person has to know, it's very, people are very difficult sometimes, or very, one person would like, another person dislikes, and what one person sees as a way to deal with them, a different person needs to be dealt with differently. And so it takes a wisdom to be at peace with everyone, to be to keep everybody happy. Hashem gave Shlomo wisdom, and therefore there was peace between him and Hiram. We were hinting to, I looked this up a little bit, that apparently Hiram felt that he was God. And so that created a little bit of a challenge. It was when you deal with a monarch who thinks that they're God, he believed in more than one God, but that he felt that he himself was divine. It was relatively common amongst the Gentiles that they that their kings, Pharaoh, also felt that he was God. And that's a whole different dimension when you feel that you're dealing with a person who feels they're infallible, they're almighty, they, you know, how...
Feel that. I mean, gosh.
Is that a whole other dimension?
Right. But that's what it says. It's an interesting tradition that Moshe Rabbeinu, Paro, one of the things that he did was that he didn't go to the bathroom in front of his subjects. He didn't never excuse himself to use the restroom because God wouldn't use a restroom, right? So what he would do is when he would go out to the Nile, for his swim, that's when he would do his... So Moshe Rabbeinu would meet him as he was going out to the Nile, and see, Paro couldn't admit that he had to go. and so that was an embarrassing moment because Paro was forced to admit that he wasn't a god. In other words, how could he deceive himself so much to think that he was a god when... It's an interesting lesson that Hashem gives us, reminds us that we're human. There's certain, you know, using the restroom is certainly a reminder that we're human, that we have waste, that we, you know, we have a body, we're physical, and somehow these kings, it went to their head. They thought that they were, they were God. And so, it'd be a challenge to deal with somebody like that, and, apparently Shlomo was able to do that, and, they made a deal. Now, we have a tradition that one of the reasons why the Beis HaMikdash was not permanent, it got destroyed, was because of the part of the labor and the materials came from Hiram. When a person does something, a mitzvah, or does something for the right sake, it's very powerful. When a person does it who's not as spiritual, it maybe doesn't have that permanent quality. And so, therefore, the question where the sources of things come from. I think I mentioned to you that there are certain areas where the state government allows churches to do bingo. They don't allow gambling, but they allow bingo because this would be a way to fund the churches and things. And so there are certain synagogues in certain areas that are funded by bingo. And there are day schools that are funded by bingo. I had a shul that was funded by bingo at one time. And some people feel that if the money, the source of the income from the shul is from gambling, and sometimes the gambling is from people that really can't afford it. You know, they take their food stamps and they gamble, and there's also, they actually bring little idols to the game, you know, to the bingo, because they're very superstitious, they're lucky numbers, they're religious numbers, and so there are people that feel that if the funding for something comes from an inappropriate thing, you'll never see success in it. And there are certain yeshivas that won't take government funding, because they feel that we're about spirituality, we're about serving Hashem, and people that want to do a mitzvah and support our synagogue or give us a donation, so that's powerful, that's a mitzvah. to just collect certain funds from the government. They feel that that's a, they don't want to, that won't be as powerful, and that'll somehow cloud our the purity of what we're trying to do. When Noah wanted to build an ark that would survive the flood, he didn't just go and buy a pre-existing boat. That would have made sense. It would have saved him a lot of time. But he actually built it from scratch. But he did even more than that. He planted the trees from scratch. Interesting idea that that's why it took so long. But the idea, though, is that when you build something from the bottom up with good intentions and it's built in a spiritual, then it has a strength to it and a permanence to it. Whereas if the source of something comes from something that's not so good, we don't know how powerful that is or how good that is. And so as great as the Beis HaMikdash was, because it came from this Gentile king who saw himself as a god, it wasn't as powerful, and it could be destroyed. The third temple, we're told, will come down from Hashem. And now, the second temple also was built with a Gentile king. Anybody know how to pronounce his name? With an X-E-R, Xerxes or something?
I think it's pronounced with a Z.
Yeah.
Who was it? Xerxes.
It was the...
Isn't it Cyrus?
Might be the English the king that gave permission to rebuild the second temple, and he sent money to help rebuild it. But there's nothing wrong in accepting donations from Gentiles and especially if a Gentile wants to do a mitzvah, right? If a person wants to do a good deed. There was a big question a while back. I think it was the conservative movement had a building donated by, was it Boesky or something, and then he was indicted for illegal money, and they changed the name, and I don't know if they gave the money back, right? But you have this in politics that whenever people are supposed to give back the donations when they find out that it came from terrorists, but because it's important where funding comes from. It makes a difference what supports a person. Where does the support come from? Is it from ill-gotten gains, or is it from the appropriate things? And so I'm just pointing out here that the temple was not as permanent as it could have been because this was part of Hashem's plan, obviously, because Shlomo, without the labor of Hiram, couldn't have done it. But we mentioned that there were certain cracks in this. From the very beginning, it wasn't built on firm ground, the first temple. Be that as it may, our understanding is that if it had been built with the purest of motives, it would have lasted forever. Now, the tabernacle, our understanding was, did last forever. It wasn't destroyed. It was buried underground. And we'll see about that, actually, the tabernacle of Moshe. But that money was given with spiritual, it was done as a mitzvah and had a permanence to it by Moshe Rabbeinu. Some people differentiate between small amounts and large amounts, where the person can... there's a certain level where gambling becomes a sickness, and then people are addicted and they can destroy their lives and others around them because they can't stop. And so if you take advantage of that, that's really not proper. Whereas gambling for recreation, there are many recreation events that people do, why is it that much different than paying for a play or doing something else? And that's how they would differentiate it. But even if it's kosher, meaning even if it's not a bad source, it's certainly not like a holy source. if you think about it, that you're praying to the king of the world and the money came from, just gambling. It's just not the same as if people gave the money with good intentions and wanting to help and wanting to, it's a special thing when somebody has, good intentions. There are all kinds of... if people when something is done with the right intentions, that makes it more powerful. When it's done with love, when it's done with a desire to, whereas when it's done, funds are collected, that's a little bit different. Okay. This one thought I'm saying here was that it takes wisdom to make peace, which is just. Some people assume it's easy. It doesn't come easy if a person is able to get along with all kinds of different people. That's a big wisdom. And some people have to realize that it's a challenge when different people come to know what to say to them and how to deal with them. And so that's the, Shlomo Hashem gave him that wisdom as a leader to be able to deal with some, and I was just mentioning that if somebody thinks they're a god, we deal with arrogant people. It's the height of all arrogance if you think you're God. It's it's pretty hard to deal with somebody like that. So, okay. 27. Now, Shlomo had to, it's like everything, someone's got to pay for it, right? So he raised the tax on the whole Jewish people. And we're going to see later on that taxes sometimes create ill will. And when people feel that they're excessive and we work hard for our money. And it's interesting, as long as Shlomo was alive, we didn't hear too many complaints. Life was good. Everybody had their vineyard. But when Shlomo's children took over, that's when we'll see later that people started grumbling, you know, maybe we could have some tax relief. It's interesting because we certainly can relate to that. It's a constant theme of life. But he did make a tax. And this particular tax was... they had a barter system. I don't know as far as... they didn't really create a currency either. But the system was that people had to donate their time. One thing that's important for people to realize, and we're used to the idea of giving charity, it's giving money. And that's a very high charity. Of course, people need money. But not all of us have money or extra money to give. So sometimes people assume that if they don't have the money to give, then they can't give charity. But you can give your time. In other words, if you can't... in other words, just like if a person can give of their income, a person can give of their time, and it's an equal mitzvah. You know, every person has certain talents that Hashem has given them, and they have a way in which they can. I knew somebody that was homebound, and they weren't that well, but they wanted to help others, and so they would call people up find out, they did a kind of biker cholim. They would find out who else was sick, and they would encourage them, and they would use that to cheer people up. It was a beautiful thing, because a person, whatever gift, whatever a person has, if they give of that of their time, that's also a... So here, the tax, you know, we're kind of stuck. We have to pay tax and money. You can't tell Uncle Sam, well, okay, I'll volunteer. I'll be out there and work off my taxes on a... yeah, that's right. So, but they sent 30,000 men, and the way they did it, they sent them up to Lebanon, 28. They sent 2,000 a month, and they'd switch off. They would go 1 month up, and then they were 2 months off. And the one who monitored this system to make sure that they had the workers up there was Adoniram. Now, it doesn't sound that efficient to be changing workers every month. Wouldn't it have been more efficient to keep them there longer? So a very interesting tradition that Shlomo felt that it was wrong to keep the men away from home more than a month. In other words, a person has a family life, and they didn't want to, as important as it was, and they said even to build the Beis HaMikdash, a person should try not to be away from their family too long. That was the lesson that Chazal learned out from here. In other words, even though this was very important, we needed volunteers to go up and build the Beis HaMikdash for Hashem Shekhinah to come down and call Yisrael, but you can't build the Beis HaMikdash on the back of your family. If you're not home, if the, you know, the breadwinner's not home, or the father, whoever it is, or the volunteer, then you can't, the Shekhinah is not a part of the, it's important, as important as the Beis HaMikdash is, it's important that the family function and that they be, everybody be there to do their part. And so therefore, he limited it to 1 month in, only 1 month of service, and then 2 months off service. And so, yes.
Why do people complain after that? I mean, they're building the
We'll get there. It's no, people don't need an excuse to complain. Meaning it's hard to know if it was really justified or it was just grumbling. It's natural that people, it seems to be almost a human need to complain. You know, we find that, you know, the people complained about the man, which was the best food. And they said, oh, it was really good in Egypt. You know, it's like that. So it's almost a, you know, it's a human frailty. Okay. So, but that, again, we just mentioned the lesson that Chazal learned that that even though the Beis Hamikdash was important, they didn't want to take away from family life more than necessary. 29. Shlomo, he had 70,000 workers, and Shmonim Elef, he had 80,000 people cutting. This was a big undertaking, especially in those times to, you have to feed those people. They didn't have refrigeration, and they have to, workers, and so this was a huge building campaign. Verse 30. Levad Mistar Nitzav. Now these were besides, they had overseers. In other words, these were the plain workers. Then you had the overseers, the Shemalacha, so there were 3,000, Horim, Ba'am, Ba'osim, Malacha. So you had, you had plain laborers, and then you had the people who knew how to, you needed just the, the energy to move the stones, and then you had the craftsmen who actually knew how to cut the stones and knew how to transport them and how to move them. 31. And the king commanded and he moved big stones. And you can look at these stones. I have a book at home. Some of the stones in the western wall are from King Solomon's time. They know it because they're different than the Herodian stones. They have they've dug all. You can go down now at the Kosel, and it goes all the way. I don't know if any of you have taken the tour where you can go all the way down to the. Do they call it the bedrock? Is that the bottom? So some of the bedrock stones, they can tell by the way they're cut that they were from the first temple, because that was still there, and so they used them, and so you can actually go and to a stone that was cut for the first Beis Hamikdash. I'm trying to remember how they had a way. The archaeologists have a way of knowing which stones were from the first and which ones were from the second. But the common thing was is that they would always, when they would rebuild, they would build on the foundations that were there from the previous. So and actually, I think there's like three layers. They have on the very top. I think that's Turkish on top of the Kosel. Those tiny stones that are up on the, and then they have the Herodian stones from the second Beis Hamikdash, and then all the way down they have the from Shlomo HaMelech. And they found that even like inscriptions on the stones in Babylonian, the workers, the little notes they had. This goes here. This goes there.
Incredible. All those years and through wars and everything.
Well, the bedrock stones are like embedded in the ground. They're dug deeply, so they would stay over time. Like if you dig deep enough, you'll find those original. Yeah. There are mysteries like how they move these stones. I think I mentioned this. They have no way without the equipment that we have today. They don't know how they physically could. You can't get enough men around to lift it up. You had to. So they think they had wheels and they had pulleys but they don't fully understand it. In other words, the scientists, they have no way of explaining how they would bring this stone of this size from as many miles away where they found the quarry to the Beis Hamikdash in this big shape without how do they do it? They don't know. They cross rivers. They don't know. It's a mystery. We don't know how they. Shlomo had. There were certain challenges in building the Beis Hamikdash, and he used his wisdom. We said he knew he knew plant life. He knew animal life. He got the elephants to pull. I don't know what he did, but his wisdom was useful in figuring out ways to help construct the temple. Yisid Abayis Avnei Gadis. That was the.
Okay, 32. Are the pyramids equally mysterious? You always hear so much about
it. It could be. There are a lot of things about ancient societies that we don't know how they did. Like, today they couldn't make a mummy like they did in those days. Like they don't know how to make it last or which chemicals they used. There are operations that were described in the Gemara that they still don't know how to do. Things that they, that they could do, some medications and things that they had, we just, don't know how they did them. 32. The Yisu b'nei Shlomo b'nei Hiram, and the builders of Shlomo and the builders of Hiram v'ha-gavilim, and these were the people who knew how to prepare the buildings and the bricks, v'hina etim, and they had wood and stones, and they prepared everything for the building. And so they laid the groundwork for the building of the Beit HaMikdash. Chapter 6. V'yi b'shmonim shana. And it was in the, it's actually shmonim shana b'arba mea shana, 480 years. Let's say Spinei Yisrael, it took 480 years after we left Egypt. There's the idea that we were wandering around until we had like a permanent presence in the land where we had our own king and where the cities were built up and where Hashem's presence would come. Now, we know Hashem is everywhere. Some people get confused by this. If Hashem's presence is everywhere, why does he need a house to be in? The answer, though, is even though Hashem is everywhere, you can feel his presence stronger in certain places. Just like time. Like, Hashem isn't all time, but certain times you feel more holy. Like Yom Kippur, Shabbos, right? And so there's like a concentration, or it's easier to feel Hashem's more intense presence. We sometimes look for that. In other words, we want to feel spiritual. And we don't necessarily have a place that we can, well, we can go to Israel, we can go to the Kosovo, but it's not the same. In other words, sometimes a person feels that they want to talk to Hashem or they want to be inspired. And so then they could go to the Beit HaMikdash and they were inspired. They felt changed. We don't know exactly how it works because we don't really have that experience. Some people say, oh, animal sacrifices, that sounds terrible. How did they? But we know that the people, let's say a person who had sinned and he had done some terrible things and he wanted a new start on life and he wanted to change his ways, that he would come, he would set aside the money and he would bring an animal to the Beit HaMikdash and he would leave a changed person and he felt different. And first he would see the animal being prepared, and when he saw the animal being killed, he thought, you know, life is so temporary, and that could be me, and I acted like an animal. And then he saw the Levites would be singing their special songs that inspired the people, and the Tehillim that were written by David HaMelech, and the process of going through the Beit HaMikdash was a fact. Even Gentiles that went there, it was extremely inspiring. It's so much so that Josephus says that the Romans really didn't intend to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. As much as they hated the Jews, they felt this place is special. We don't want to knock it down. Other people say that they hated us so much they were willing to do it. But it is a fact that the Beit HaMikdash was a place where we could go to recharge our spiritual batteries, where we could be inspired, where we could be moved, where we could refocus ourselves. That loss is something that we don't have that. And it was a place of peace where people could go and they could resolve their issues. And it was it's an experience that we don't have. The closest thing we have to bringing a korban today, is the Passover Seder. The Passover Seder is actually modeled after the Passover sacrifice. Except we don't have lamb. I think some people have lamb at the Seder. I always get that call before Passover. Where do I get the Passover lamb? The Paschal lamb. I say, well, we don't do that nowadays. But we all can't always describe what's special about the Seder. When they brought a sacrifice, most of the part that went on the altar, there is, by the sin offering, you don't get any steaks. That's the sin offering was an atonement. That gets all burnt up. That's like a waste. A person wastes his life. You made a mistake. But most of the offerings were what we call shlamim, were peace offerings. And shlamim, basically a person invited their family and friends, and they purified themselves, and they had like a big Passover Seder, and they ate it in holiness in the temple. And 95% of the animal went to the owner. A small percentage of the certain fats that we don't eat anyways were burned on the altar. There were the paw, the jaw, and the maw. That usually went to the Kohen. But the vast majority of the animal would be eaten, and it would be... it was part of the temple, the service there. But again, it's just, we can't get into, trying to see it. Today, you can't go to a slaughterhouse and say, oh, I wasn't inspired by that, because you're missing the whole point. It wasn't just that an animal was killed that brought the Shekhinah down, and it was part of the whole system of the Beis HaMikdash, that this was the place where the Beis HaMikdash, the Jewish court, the Supreme Court, was located in the Beis HaMikdash. Because that was where anybody could get justice, and that's where the Torah laws came out from, Kimitzion Teitzei Torah, and there was a whole, there was music there, and there was spirituality, and there was rejoicing, and it's so hard for us to really know, but we know from reading from the people of the times, Jews and Gentiles, that it was a very unique and special place. Now, in the Gentile places, by the idols of the time, they had human sacrifices. People were often killed in front of the idols. In South America today, they dug up the ruins of the ancient society. They find human sacrifices. They find people with their hearts missing. You know, things, just disgusting things. And the ancient idols all had, part of the service were orgies, prostitution and orgies, and it was all part of the, part of their service. It was the opposite of holiness. So, in Judaism, where we had this service where people would go and they'd be inspired and they would be, they would feel close to Hashem and they'd feel close to one another, and, the word, like I mentioned, the word shlamim, peace offerings, some people feel that the word actually shalom means complete. It meant that if a person was missing something, he walked away whole. In other words, that it's not so much a peace. The peace means the completeness. The person is, there's really a lot to say about what the role of the temple was. And what the role of the offerings were, and we'll talk a little bit about the different the things that were in the temple. You have the menorah, you have the aron, you have the, because it was a long time ago, and because a lot of it was symbolism and Kabbalah and mystical, and because we don't have a strong way to relate to it, sometimes like a person has been to the Kosel and they don't. They went there and they cried like a baby and they thought it was unique and they went, it was special, and they don't know exactly why, but they know that they felt connected there. But then there are people who've been there who said it's a nice wall. You know, I don't know. It didn't do anything for them. It didn't attract them. I had a relative that wasn't particularly religious, and when he went to Israel, he told me that as the plane settled down, he felt like he was coming home. This was his first and only visit to Israel, and what was it about it? It's a feeling that you have it. You're coming home when you go to Israel. That's the we know that as a place it worked, and that it was an important part of society, and having that in the middle of Yerushalayim meant that society revolved around the Beis HaMikdash, the place where the Shekhinah would be. It meant that people saw that their role in life was to have Hashem's presence among us, and to have Hashem in our daily lives and involved with us, and to be godlike and to be in the image of Hashem. And so that really was a high point of the society, and so Shlomo sought to build that Beis HaMikdash there. One other part of it was that until that time, people would have their own backyard little temples that they had, a backyard barbecue altar. And the people were tribal. In other words, one tribe would do their thing, another tribe would do their thing. And there's something special when there's unity, when everybody gets together. It's why, like even part of the beauty of Beth Jacob is it's a big place. You have so many different kinds of people coming together. There's a certain special feeling. Now, it's true, we all have our certain favorite tune or favorite variety of place to daven, but when you can go to a big place where just by the volume of different people there, you feel the togetherness of being part of the group. And so one thing that Shlomo HaMelech wanted to do was everybody had their backyard, little place that was convenient, that was their style, they liked their steaks raw, whatever it is, they had their own. And it was so strong that it was difficult to get rid of. And we're going to see that throughout the book, even once we had a Beis HaMikdash, and in theory, people were supposed to stop doing their own little thing, it didn't help. Today, people call that like the shtiebelization. A small synagogue is called a shtiebel. And it's very common in religious neighborhoods that you have many different shtibbles. Everybody has, you know, you have, we're all, you know, in Western society, we've got, you know, we don't have one flavor. We don't have chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. We have 31 flavors. We have 60 flavors. If you, you know, ketchup or cereal, go down the cereal aisle. How many different kinds of cereal are there, you know, or soda or bottled water? There's a dozen kinds of bottled water. So it's like we like variety in our lives. We don't want to all have to do the same thing. We all want to be unique and different and special. And so the challenge is with our goal to be unique and special and different, how to share things together with everybody where we're forced to all adopt the same. But that was what Shlomo wanted, because there's huge value to unity when people can all bring their uniqueness together in the Beis HaMikdash. But it didn't come easy, and we're going to see that still people sometimes wanted to go and do their own thing, do the backyard and the you know, altar kind of thing. So Shlomo builds the house for Hashem. Now, let's start the verse 1 again. It was 480 years. It's interesting, I have to go through the years again. I think the first Beis HaMikdash was 480, and then the second one was 480. There's some interesting things if you make comparison with the years. Now, when was it started? Bechodesh Ziv. It was in the month of Ziv. It's in the springtime, which is interesting. It's time for building. It's a time for renewal. It's in the air. It's the second month, Limlo Shlomo Yisrael. Now, this was the actual, the Vayivan Abayis Lashem, and he built, this is when he began the construction. Now, this was the fourth year of his reign. Now, why did he wait till the fourth year? I mean, David HaMelech had already prepared everything. So why did he wait 4 years? So, some people say that he just it took him a while to get used to governing and get the people ready, and you know, that took a few years to be established. In other words, it took till he settled in. You can't start building on your first day. You know, I'm the new king. All right, let's go. You know, until he still.
How old was he? Too?
That's also quite. It was a teenager, probably, according to most people. There's two different views: whether he was in his 20s or in his teens when he started. So, but this would have been, yeah. So this would have been 4 years in. But he needed some time to prepare or some time to get ready to start the construction.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. When it says the 480th year after the children of Israel came out of Egypt, does 480 include the 40 years wandering in the desert, or does it start when they enter Israel?
I believe it started from when they. I think it includes the 40 years in refuge. I believe so. Okay. Verse 2. Now goes through the dimensions. So Kabbalistically, there's things, reasons for all the numbers. There's studies of numbers, what the numbers mean. And but to us, on a simple level, we'll just read it. The Shishim Ama Orcho Vashim Rachvos, 60 by 20 by 30. That's the dimension. And then they had verse 3. Va'ula Malpnei Hecho. You had the... There was different parts of the Beis HaMikdash itself. In other words, you had the Holy of Holies, and you had the area where the Kohanim were, and then you had the entrance hall. That's the Ulam here. That was Eshimama Orchal Pnei. Maybe we'll bring in a visual if we can. It's interesting, in recent times, because of the new software that they have available, they've been able to reconstruct a large part of the temple, and they have these CDs where they can show you, like, you know, you can point to different things, and they're able to scale it much easier. Because you know, when you go and let's say you want to plan a building, if you want to make your dream house, so they have software where you can go and, oh, I want a room over here and I want to pull back here, and they can actually make you a diagram. So somebody did that with the temple, and so it allows a lot more visual. They have to get an idea of what it was. With that said, there's still a lot of guesswork. So sometimes they vary. As to what the temple looked like. One interesting thing, we just had Hanukkah, and there's a debate about how the menorah looked. And we have, our tradition is that the menorah has the round branches. But I don't know if you know, Chabad has this tradition that they have the The angles, yeah. So it's a lot of questions about what, you know, it was a long time ago. We have the Romans, when they destroyed the temple, they built an archway as a memorial for their victory. And on the archway, they show them carrying the temple, the menorah, out. And there they have it depicted as round. So the only thing is, they also show like snakes on the base of it. Somebody did some artwork on the bottom of the base of the, and so there's also poetic license. So, you know, it's hard. Who knows how accurate it was, drawn to scale, or was just a part of the. We don't know if, you know, when the person, you know, drew the menorah, maybe he had a. Some people said there was the menorah, and then they also had things for light. You know, they had lamps and things. Maybe this was some other. Might have been something for the Sanhedrin. You know, so it's hard to know. There is a tradition that a lot of the artifacts are still in the Vatican. That was where during the Middle Ages, there were sages that, when they were studying these things, managed to have friends in the Vatican who would show them what the vessels looked like. And so now, when the Vatican says, well, when Rome was sacked 800 years ago, all the vessels were lost, they're not telling the truth. Because Rashi's time and other times, 350 years ago, there were people who were in Rome, and Rome hasn't been sacked since then, and they had these vessels. They had things, you know, they had some of the vessels from the temple. So at any rate, they have this big ulam, hey, Rabbi Shabba Amarav, that's in front of the house. Verse 4. Yas Labayas Chaloni Shkufi. Anybody ever wonder if they had windows on the base of Migdash, right? So they did have windows. Otherwise, it'd be pretty dark in there, I guess. Well, no, they. But the interesting thing is, they're described in verse 4. Vayas, let's try this. Yas Labayas, they made Chaloni Shkufim Atumim. They made windows that are described as the word chalon. We still have that today. That means windows. But they were shkufim and atumim. Shakuf usually means like open, and atum means like closed, like narrow and wide. Usually the way you make a window is you want the light to come in from outside and lighten up the inside. So we have a tradition that the real light comes from Hashem. In fact, when Hashem created the world and it talks about light, many people say that light is Hashem. Light is often a metaphor for Hashem, because light, when things are dark, everything is confusing, we can't see things, and when you have light, all of a sudden everything becomes clear. When things are dark, people are cold, and, you know, it was cloudy last week, it was terrible, you know, you wanted the sun to come through, and you feel so much better when there's that sunlight. And so that's really a metaphor for Hashem, that when the light comes through, then we can see, then we're warm, then there's clarity. So light represents like a wisdom, like, you know, you have a fire and you can share the fire. You know, you can give somebody a light and you don't lose anything. It's like wisdom is meant to be shared, and it spreads, and you grow more by sharing the light. And so oftentimes, like, we think of Hashem as being a kind of light. That's a kind of... So our tradition had it that instead of... since the Beis HaMikdash was Hashem's house, he didn't need light from the outside. In fact, the light came from the inside. And so they made the windows backwards, that the light from the temple shone out. It was to let the light of the temple out rather than to bring the light from the sun in. And that's the Shkufim Atumim.
How do you do that?
I don't know enough about window construction to know the... my assumption is that, I guess, it's wider at one point and more narrow at another, but I don't know enough the how the...
But the window is thin.
Well, they had thick walls.
Yeah, the walls are pretty... These were stone walls, and so they had there's certain signs to... I often look at these kind of... The windows here in the Kovel are very... actually, if you look at them, the... that's narrow on the outside and wide on the inside. I'm looking at those. Now, maybe that's what they look like in the temple, that they were wide on the inside. Usually, you'd make them the other way. I need someone in construction to tell me. I always thought windows were, it was even throughout, but apparently there was a wide and a narrow that was involved.
Noah's Ark? Wasn't there something also?
Also something like that. That? Mm, yeah. Okay, verse 5.
Maybe there was a window, an inner window and an outer window?
Could be. Don't know.
If the walls were thick and wide, you'd think that there would have to be two in order to...
I don't know. It doesn't say anything about glass. I don't know if they had glass
in the wall.
Yeah, they might have been holes in the wall. I don't know if they had glass at all. Verse 5. By even Alakira by Sutsu, and then they had different chambers. As a Kirisa by Savil Heko Dvir, and they had an area called the Dvir, but yes, Lo Saviv. They had these different chambers for different functions that were taking place over there. Vahayitzava Tachtona, and the smaller one was 5 amas wide, Batichona Shesh Ba'ama, by 6 amas. An amma, by the way, is a hand breath. In other words, from the top of the shoulder to the top, it's about a foot and a half. That's about an amma. Ki Migras Nasal Abai Savi Chutze Bilti Ochas, they also... They had the beams, you had to have cross beams to hold things up. It's also, if you never did building before, this itself was one of the wisdoms that Shlomo had, to know how to build something that would last. It lasted a long time to know how to build with heavy stones. If you don't have it right, the stones will cave in. 7 Abayas, Vivnasa, Evan Shlema. And it was built of a complete stones. Masa Nivna, Umakavas. Now, one of the challenges that they had was that they couldn't use weapons, things that are used in weapons to construct the Beis HaMikdash. And it's part of the lesson is that violence doesn't lead to good things. We don't believe in using weapons in the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. And so therefore they didn't use metal or the kind of stone cutting that they used to have. Kokli Barzel, Lo Nisha, you didn't hear the hammering that you would normally hear in construction. They weren't able to do it. The tradition has it that they had a special kind of creature that they used to cut the stones, the Shamir. That was the name of it. It's interesting. Somebody did find a kind of creature that actually is able to cut stone. I saw an article about it. Because this was mysterious. We don't know of today. It's not kind. We don't know of any kind of worm or creature that's able to cut stones or what it's able to do. There is an idea that in the tabernacle that we had in the desert, there was a multicolored animal that appeared. And it made these beautiful skins. They usually translated as a seal. We weren't in the North Pole. There were no seals in the Sinai Desert. I mean, where'd they get a seal from? But there's a tradition that Hashem sent this creature there because we needed these beautiful skins to decorate our tabernacle. And so there's the idea when the Beis HaMikdash was being constructed, Hashem sent along exactly what was needed. Sometimes we're in need of something, sometimes it's a job, sometimes it's a person, and they just come along at the right time, and it's unusual, but it's exactly what's needed at that time. And so here also, this creature was found at that time that helped them in this construction, other than the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, it was no longer necessary, so we no longer have it, or maybe it exists in some far-off place, just like those, I don't know why they call it seals, they don't have a good name for it. It was like a multicolored animal that was found.
The Tachash,
yeah, that was found in the desert. Coyotes are not colorful. It just wouldn't go. Okay, we'll stop here on verse 8.